I was 23. And I was like, why didn't you do this? And I was like, well, that's because, I was like, Jeremy, you didn't do it because you don't want a daddy. You want to be your own daddy. So then I wrote Daddy, which in so many ways became my daddy. Like, Daddy is the play that got me into Yale. Daddy is the play that got me a production in London, got me a production in Japan, got me my first A24 movie. I was not born with a daddy in any way, shape, or form.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of High Low with Imrata. Today, we have on my friend Jeremy O'Harris. He is an incredible playwright, writer. He lives in New York City. You may know his play Slave Play, which went to Broadway. I'm really excited to have Jeremy on because I admire his writing about sex and power dynamics and race and the ability he has to tackle really large political issues while also still being funny. So without further ado, Jeremy O'Harris.
Stay tuned for more High Low with Imrata.
Welcome back to High Low with Imrata. Why were you up until 7 a.m.? Let's start there.
So I am now a member of the Academy of Motion Pictures.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a part of the new young members. I didn't know this, but they send you a text and call you every day when voting starts to remind
what?
You to. Yes.
That's annoying.
It's annoying, but it's also kind of cool because I'm like, now no one has an excuse to not right. like vote. It's like they should do this in America for elections. Like if everyone was getting bombarded, you would do it. You'd still procrastinate like I've been doing, but you'd do it. So last night I watched To Leslie and an animated feature named Inuo, and another movie that I'm really obsessed with right now called Saint Omer, and Babylon. Babylon, have you ever seen that meme from Real Housewives of Atlanta? You know, just, you know, I like the beat.
Yes.
It was
that's
very
how you
that for me.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, I
see what you were doing there.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
But it wasn't it.
There's a really difficult blackface scene in the movie that I have questions about. And I think that really, and again, I'm not someone who's like, you can't do this or that in a movie. Because I wrote Slave Play. Like, I believe that people should test themselves and test their limits. Mm-hmm. But I think that as a black audience member and as someone who I think was quite responsible with how I like utilized like a lot of our sort of historically violent images, I was curious about why a character who was sort of a side character in this ensemble was utilized in that manner and why we needed to see it. Because I don't know that
right.
we needed to see the black, I think we could have seen the blackface be applied and not have to see the image of the blackface and still gotten the point. Oh. And then also like just the characterization that led up to that, just it was curious to me. I
so
wonder
it
what was
like
cut.
Felt like a shocking moment for no reason.
Yeah, and like I also think that maybe there was something that, I mean, it's a 3-hour movie. So I think that there's maybe like 10 minutes of characterization that got cut that like.
Have you noticed that a lot of people kind of like try to talk about race or gender in a way now just to be like, we talked about it. It's relevant, and they like slip it into like something that has nothing to do with it.
Absolutely.
I hate that.
What's really sad to me is that I do think that there's this, I think in the moment where we started to talk more consciously about race as a construct, how white people have benefited from white supremacy, things we've been talking about for decades, mm-hmm. but things that I think that like the layperson was starting to hear more, and so yeah. people who have the keys to power had to like act like they had just discovered it too. That moment made people think about my identity and your identity. Mm-hmm. And yet like white men still like don't actually dissect their identity. And I'm like, no, you know that when like Godfather is being made, that's still an identitarian movie, not just because it's Italian, but because it's about like masculinity
right.
and like white masculinity.
I mean, that's one of my favorite moments in White Lotus is when they talk about the Godfather and
yes.
like the three generations, and it's good, and like a conversation about masculinity and the Godfather.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like Mike White is someone who's always been able to like ask questions about his whiteness in a really, even in like a space like School of Rock, he's asking questions about his whiteness.
Huh. I haven't seen that in a long time.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Are you writing a lot for TV and film? You are, right?
I mean,
which do you prefer?
I prefer writing theater.
Okay.
I really do. I mean, I think that one of the things about theater is that you have your autonomy.
Hmm.
You're not worried about, like, the price differential for making a play and making a movie is just so astronomical. Even a small movie costs like $400,000.
Yes.
Whereas
the smallest.
Yes.
Yeah.
And whereas like, but like a good small movie, right, that you kind of want to do is 10 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
no,
the kind of
legitimate.
Small movie you want to
yeah.
do is 10 million. Whereas like a good small play, you can do for 10 grand. And so the pressure isn't as much there on like what an audience is gonna think, right? So you can like kind of have full authorship.
You can play more.
Yeah. I worked on a TV show for HBO for 2 years. Me and another writer named Aziza Barnes both got hired to write the adaptation of The Vanishing Half. So we both pitched our idea for it. We both separately got hired to write the same show together. And then we pitched our version of it together. And I think that we did exactly what we said we were going to do. And I think just because of like the facts of television, right? Mm-hmm. I think that like when you want to do something a little experimental, a little honest, and also when you want to do those things with Black people in a period piece, it becomes, people start thinking about the bottom line and they start wondering like, how big can our audience be? Like,
yeah, when you say the facts of TV, you mean like the business of TV.
The business of TV. Like right now, if your show isn't bringing in numbers or lots of awards immediately, it's getting canceled after one season.
It's so crazy. I mean, entertainment in general, it's like TikTok's just taking everything out.
Did you enjoy working more in film? Or like, do you want to do it? How do you feel about your life as an actress?
I mean, the reason I ever started modeling was because I started in theater, actually. I loved theater as a kid. And I just loved being on stage and just the ritual of theater. Like, I really enjoy that. And I mean, like the performance, but just that you get this kind of experience, you know, and it's so, you're in the moment, you're so present, and it's really exhilarating. I basically like got famous from modeling and everyone was like, she's so great on camera, she should be an actress. And I was like, okay. And then had very specific experiences with the men that work in film. And I hated them and resented them. And it made me hate acting. I actually had a great experience with Gone Girl, but it wasn't like totally disconnected kind of from overall how I felt. Like I was being seen by Hollywood and it made me super depressed and it made me feel really disconnected from acting. And you know, when I started writing my book, I was like, the only way I would return to film is if I am a part of the making of things. And I know everyone says that, but for me, it's really specific.
I have a lot of empathy for that. I think that I've had a lot of trouble connecting to my voice as a writer this year because of the trauma of doing 20 different rewrites of a show that everyone said they wanted and feeling like you're never going to get it right.
Well, it sounds like why you even like theater more is because of control,
yes.
Right? And that's how I am. Everything I do in my life, I like control. I hated the schedule of my life as an actor. It was so up to someone else. It was like months and months. And then I had no idea if what I was doing was of any quality because I wasn't the artist. I was just like a pawn in someone else's chessboard. And I was like, these people are, first of all, like bad at what they do. I think I could do a better job. Yeah. And also like I'm dedicating months of my life. I don't have like any autonomy or control. You know, also 10 years ago, I think everyone was like, oh, if you want to be taken seriously, you have to be an actor. Like mm-hmm. that is what you do. If you want to have longevity, blah, blah, blah. And I think some part of me was defiant and was like, no, I'm going to do it how I want to do it, which I did, which was via Instagram and then like writing a book of essays and what, you know what I mean? And people were like, the fuck?
Yes.
But I wanted that.
But also we're Geminis.
That's true.
We're Geminis.
That is true.
People can't fuck with our power. And we see mm-hmm. too many. Having the galaxy brain of a Gemini can be both oppressive and liberating at the same time.
When's your birthday?
June 2nd.
Okay. June 7th.
I know. It's a good one.
You're like, oh, I know.
Isn't that the same day as Northwest?
Prince has the same birthday as
oh,
me.
Oh, that's, oh my
I know,
God.
It's
that's
a
really
one.
Good one.
It's a really good
people,
one.
When you think about all the artists who are Geminis, it's like, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, guys. Like, no other sign compares when it comes to creativity,
okay.
Right? Kendrick Lamar, Kanye, the Olsen twins, you know?
Yes. Like, I think maybe we share like we're a day apart or something, the Olsen twins. Yeah.
I could name more, but you know.
It's fine.
Azalea Banks.
I mean, yeah. She should have been first. Stay tuned for more High Low with Emrata.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop, always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
Welcome back to High Low with Emrata.
Can we talk about Slave Play? When you started writing, did you write, you wrote Daddy first, right?
Yes.
Which
yes.
I saw and
yes.
loved.
Yes, so that's kind of when we became friends. Yeah, like around Daddy.
Yeah, that's
yes.
true.
Yeah. Okay, so for those who don't know, Daddy, a melodrama, it's about an interracial relationship between a 26-year-old Black gay man and a 50 to 60, depending on which actor we cast, 50 to 60-year-old white art collector. And the Black gay man is an artist, and the white man is an art collector. And it's about their May-December romance takes place on the verge of the young Black man having his first major show. Right as the show opens, his mother comes in from the South, and a really lovely psychomachia happens around a pool between his mother and his sugar daddy.
And the stage has a pool on it.
Yeah. I wrote Daddy in like 3 weeks, and it was so good. And like, I had a great rewrite that my friend Mitchell Savello like made me do. I'm shouting him out because everyone needs to know, you need that one friend who'll be like, this play is great, but the second act sucks. Rewrite
yeah.
it. You know, he made me rewrite it, and then he paid for my first reading of it. And I'll always thank him for that. When the play premiered in London, I got to do this dazed interview about it. And I was like, you know, I was not born with a daddy in any way, shape, or form. You know, this goes back to this whole like NepKid thing. Like, I'm just like, I'm so over it. I think it's so boring because like, I literally went to high school with kids whose parents and grandparents had ownership of different people in my family, right? Because of actual slavery in Virginia, right? Which is like so psychotic. Anyway, so because of that, and because of the fact that I was able to rise beyond that space and like achieve all the things I've achieved, I have no, if your mom or your dad is whomever the fuck, I could care less. Cause like, I will still beat you in this race, right? Or at least keep pace.
Very Gemini. I like the TikToks where people are like, I am a Nepo baby because my dad, like whatever, was like yes. worked at Panda Express and hired me.
It's so good. Yeah. But so I was in a moment in LA when a lot of my friends were dating older sugar daddies. And I would go to these parties with these like very wealthy men, mainly a lot of white men. And I would be ignored by them on every sexual level and be completely friend zoned and sort of like mentored by these like older white gay men. And I was like, this is
because they didn't see you as sexual?
No, I was not a Ken doll. You know, they saw me as someone who was like actually an intellectual equal. And like, I would go to their house and all the other boys would be like doing K and Coke and like jumping into the pool like naked or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, wait, is that a cocooning? You know, and then they'd be like, oh yeah, it is. And like, you know, because they're just standing on the side watching.
Honestly,
the boys.
We had a similar experience in that way.
It's crazy when you're the one who doesn't want to jump in the pool.
Yeah, and wants to kind of impress people by being a little pretentious and snotty. I mean, when I was like 20, that was my shit.
Exactly. I do think that in my own way, that was also how I knew I could like trap a nigga. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the men that were attracted to me were always attracted to my intellect. So,
well, they double take you, right? Then you're in a different category.
Exactly.
You know how to play the game.
Exactly.
That's why you beat all the Nepo babies.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I was very excited by the fact that no one ever wanted me in that way. And I got to meet these guys as friends and wasn't dismissed by them. But then one night, one of these guys, a very, very famous guy, or a very, very wealthy guy, not famous because it's, you know, wealth whispers. He had a party at his house, and like all of my charms about like, you know, oh, is that this artist? Is that this artist? They were working on him in a deeply sexual way. And he like grabbed me by my legs and said, you have legs like Naomi. I want to see you in my pool. And I started laughing. And then he was like, come with me on this trip next week. And I was like, no, like I cannot. And then I went home to my friend's apartment that I was staying in, sleeping on the couch. And I was like, Jeremy, are you dumb? He's going to Saint-Tropez with a bunch of boys. Like, this could change your life. Like, why?
How old were you?
I was 23. And I was like, why didn't you do this? And I was like, well, that's because, I was like, Jeremy, you didn't do it because you don't want a daddy. You want to be your own daddy. So then I wrote Daddy, which in so many ways became my daddy. Like, Daddy is the play that got me into Yale. Daddy is the play that got me a production in London, got me a production in Japan, got me my first A24 movie.
Yeah, you know? You created your own daddy and yes. then thus became your own daddy yes. through the just talking about the dynamic of having a daddy.
Yes, and like the complications of it. I mean, I think, you know, so much of that play is also me confronting something I hadn't talked about a lot, because part of the ways I had been able to cope and navigate through my early childhood was by lying about my actual paternity.
In what way?
I conflated I had two stepdads in elementary school. I conflated both of my stepdads as like my one father, ignored the fact that my mom had me with a man that like left her when I was 2 months old. And then she ended up having to get like, you know, stress married when I was three to my first stepdad, who was a drug addict and not a great guy. And then got stress married again when I was 11 after the first husband cheated on her. And to a horrible guy, like a truly horrible guy. And so I put all these guys together as one guy who's like this complicated, like, man who, like, you know, disowned me because, like, you know, he thought I was queer. I told people everyone thought I was queer at the time because, like, that was because it was more believable that, like, I was metrosexual and, like, misunderstood by black, like, right. men than that I was actually just gay and didn't know my dad. I also wanted to be honest with myself about the fact that I don't know my dad. And I had only met my dad one time when I was 8 years old.
Have you met him now?
No,
I mean, just that's it.
That's the one time.
Okay.
And, you know, what's crazy is when you grow up without a dad, people tell you all the time, like, one day you're gonna get so famous, or when they think you're gonna get famous.
And he's come knocking.
Yeah, he's gonna come knocking and ask you for something. And during the pandemic, I had a really humbling moment with that 7-year-old kid who, like, I think had a lot of ambition because of those ideas.
Mm-hmm. You were hoping that it would bring your daddy back around.
I don't think
your success, yeah, at least subconsciously.
Yeah, I don't think consciously I was, yeah. Definitely subconsciously. I think that a little part of me was like, wow. And after I was on Emily in Paris.
If you're important enough, your dad will come around.
Yes, and I'll get to have that
crazy
moment.
That things that motivate us.
Yeah, right.
So crazy.
And I thought that in my mind I'd be like, you know, he'd see me on Emily in Paris and or read about me on Broadway and be like, oh my God, my son, my genes, he did that. Let me call him. And then he'll call me and I'll be like, fuck you. Like, how dare you?
Yeah.
I don't have a dad. My mom was my dad. And like do this whole monologue. But then he never called. And so then I Googled him during the pandemic. I was like, well, maybe he's dead. Like, for all I know, he's dead. Nope, he's thriving. He is literally thriving.
What do you mean? In Hawaii?
He's in Hawaii.
This man's in Hawaii.
He's in Hawaii, thriving. He's Christian, like vibing with his wife, like okay. just like no cares in the world. Two sons in the world that he has never talked to.
Wow.
And I'm like, that being a man is wild. Like, it's a cis straight man is a wild psychology.
When I came and saw Daddy, your mom was in the audience, and I remember it was like a really touching moment. Because Slave Play had already been on Broadway.
It had been off Broadway.
Yeah. And that's what got you into Yale School of Drama?
Yes.
Okay.
Daddy got me into Yale School of Drama.
I read your piece, your play about Yale.
Yeah. But when I was at Yale, my teachers really hated the play. One teacher in particular really came for it and was very not about it.
Why?
And I have reasons for why I think they were the way they were. I think it had more to do with power and control and less to do with like the content of the play, given the content of the plays they've written and been a part of but again, this is also right after Me Too. I think a lot of people felt really out of their bodies and didn't know what to think about like any of what we were doing anymore. So I give grace because of that. But I do think that the way it manifested felt like it was more about control and power than about what was actually happening in the room. We did it in this 85 person auditorium where people could see, like, there was an audience on this side, and this side. And so everyone could see everyone. And it was a mix of the 20 something black and brown people from my class at Yale and the gray hairs of the New Haven community who come to see every play because they're looking for the next Lupita.
Right.
Watching this play and the gasp, because it was also like the lights were bright the entire time. So everyone could see everyone.
Wow.
And that was when I knew I was cooking with gas because like we got a standing ovation. It like made sense. But it was hard that first hour. And you saw people actually engaging in the audience, the way the characters are engaging on the stage.
Being present in the room, which is why you love theater so much. Yeah.
I mean, what was really cool about my show on Broadway, which again, was invisibilized because I think people had their own subjective experience of whatever audience they saw. But like, according to the statistics we had the youngest audience on Broadway the year we did it and the most first time ticket buyers of any show on Broadway. When I was doing it, we did a lot of outreach to young Black and brown people. So it was like actually really wild to be there on the nights when it was a fully mixed audience and you see young Black people looking at the old white people who are laughing at different things than they are, and like the sort of the silent conversations that would pass through a glance.
I mean, it's a play in itself, right? You were having a dialogue about race and class in a space where what was going on stage was also about race and class.
I mean, this started at Yale. Mm-hmm. New Haven is really difficult.
Yeah.
Being like a Black person who has to walk by multiple Black unhoused people to get to your school that has one of the largest endowments in the world is really, and when they're telling you things like, you know, I got us an extra day during orientation because we had this cop come to our school and they like told us that like, they're like, there are people here who are gonna want what you guys have earned. And like, you know, you had to ignore them and blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, he also—
Oh my God.
Yeah, and I was like, excuse me, that is not how we talk about privilege. Also like, everything you're saying is so racially coded. It's so fucked. I don't feel safe here. I'm leaving. And I sent an email to the entire school. And then like the sheriff came back and like apologized the next day. It was like the chief of police.
I mean, that's a wild thing to say, so like crazy. Protect yourself because there's so many poor people who are
I had been followed by the cops in New Haven. And I was just followed by the cops when I was with five other Black guys the other day. I don't know that you guys are protecting anyone. I think you guys are like profiling people. And then he was like, how dare you say that? The next time you see a cop following you, just go up to the window and knock and say, here I am, I'm a student here, and they'll leave you alone. I was like, a Black person shouldn't have to prove that they are a Yale student.
Also, like, you going up to a cop car, do you think that's safe? That's a wild thing to say.
It was a Black cop that said it too. It was really crazy.
I mean, that's what gets really complicated. Maybe that's your next play.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for more High Low with Emrata. Welcome back to High Low with Emrata. How did Slave Play come about?
So basically, after I wrote Daddy, I had this like crazy idea. You know, I don't tell people what Slave Play is about. I say Slave Play is a slave play and you should go see it. And it was based on a conversation I'd had with a straight guy at a party where he was telling me about this really messed up sexual experience he had and how like this girl wanted him to like come into her house, choke her, and beat her up a little bit. And it was totally consensual. And it was the hottest thing that's ever happened to him. And I was like, that's weird. Also, like, it's like not weird that she desired that or that like you engaged in it necessarily, but it's weird to me that you're telling a bunch of strangers at a party about this gleefully.
Right.
And also hinting very loudly about who this girl was. And also calling yourself a feminist because you went to Sarah Lawrence. Like all of these things
I hate
ick.
Everything about this.
Yes. And so then I decided to make everyone uncomfortable. And I was like, what race was she? And he was like, what? And I was like, what race was she? And he was like, oh, she was white. And I was like, he was like, but I don't know what that has to do with it. I was like, well, how would you feel if it was a Black girl? And she had like asked you to do all those things and wanted you to call her the N-word. Would you have felt as comfortable like telling us all about that story? He's like, no, because I would never do that. And I was like, why wouldn't you do that? And he was like, because. And then this Black girl that was in the circle with us, she was like, but what if I get off on that? And then like, we like had this really funny like exchange, all of us, about like what the what ifs of it all. And I was like, this is a play. And so I had this idea for the play. I knew exactly how it would start. And I knew that it would be about a Black woman wants her white partner to just like listen to her and like engage with what she desires on this like kink level.
Well, acknowledge a dynamic that so many people try to not acknowledge, but is without a doubt present. Right?
Yes.
That's what I love about all of your work, is like it's a way of bringing out the dynamics that are there, but that we don't want to talk about or address. Yeah.
That's really kind.
Well, that's what I'm super interested in that.
And so basically I was like, you know, what happens when a white man tells a Black woman like what you want for yourself is wrong, right? It all came to me in a flash. And I wanted to be set now, because I was also tired of white people going to see a 12 Years a Slave or an Octoroon and being able to be like, wow, it was so bad then. And ignoring the fact that like like literally Harriet Tubman was alive at the same time as Thomas Jefferson and Ronald Reagan, which is insane. Like that's how close we are in time.
I remember reading that and thinking like, what?
Yes. I mean, even when you see the black and white pictures from like the 1960s, it feels so far away. And it's like, no, that's literally 5 seconds ago, mm-hmm. historically.
Well, and also just there's such a, I think people walk away from feeling like they checked a box, right? And they're like, well, we're acknowledging the history because I watched this beautiful black woman be violently raped in this like kind of like sexy and glamorized way.
Yes.
It's like, yes. What?
Yes.
And also like, what does that mean for where we are today?
Yeah. Where do we go from that? How do we bring the lens back or the mirror, right? Which is all around in slave play, back on like how we're moving through the world now and how we're still, I don't know all the reasons why Lupita did or did not go on to do as many like leading roles as some of her other female actress peers who won the same award. But I do think that being a black woman had something to do with the kind of role she was given after her Oscar, right? And I wonder why Hollywood was able to celebrate that and not immediately be like, oh, fuck. How do we make a space for this girl to be the lead in the next rom-com, to be like our La La Land girl, to be our Katniss Everdeen? Like all these things that happen for the other girls.
What do you think about the whole license to talk about things like kind of identity politics around slave play and the critique of that? And like, you're not a black woman, so how could you speak to this? Whatever. How do you feel about that when as a critic and also as an artist?
I mean, I think that what's complicated is that a lot of the conversations we have about these things, the critiques we have of these things, are related to capital and not actually morals, right? But we've had to conflate a moral argument with a argument around protecting capital and who gets to earn capital from X, Y, or Z. So I don't think that anyone is saying like an intelligent white person cannot write a like empathetic and intelligent black character. But I think that people are saying like, we are tired of white people being the only ones that make money from writing black characters.
Sure.
And yet I think that what's frustrating is that some people are only hearing that like, you're not allowed to. And making that like a full stop, like that is the rule. Like, why would you do anything else?
You're like, it's about money.
And it's like, no, let's just talk about what it's about. It's about money. And I think that like, if you are a responsible creator, you're aware of those things and you do things to change them, right? Like Ryan Coogler, who's the director of Black Panther, Creed, and obviously Wakanda Forever, is one of my favorite directors. And he doesn't get celebrated enough for the fact that he's had a female DP for almost every single one of his films.
Wow.
That's like a rare thing for a male auteur. And of course, it would be like the black male who's made like, you know, one of the highest grossing films of all time to be one of the loudest silent supporters of women in film, right? And I think that that's why he's able to tell like such a detailed and feminist story with Wakanda Forever, right? Mm-hmm. Without placating or trying or even getting like caught up, because he's leveled the playing field his entire career around like celebrating women behind the scenes, that when he starts doing it in front of the screens, it doesn't feel weird, you know?
Right. Well, it's the opposite of signaling, because he actually politically believes in like capital for women in film.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that what I want to see more people thinking about when they talk about, you know, what they can and can't do is like, how can I tell this story while also bringing as many voices to the table that can help me tell the story better?
And do you do that with your own work?
I do that all the time with my work. I mean, that's like been a backbone of my work the entire time. And I think that that invisible labor is something that can't be discussed quite easily in the like gotcha space of a take on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok.
You lose the nuance of who consulted who, of how you've considered this other perspective.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting how much you've written about sex.
I write a lot about sex.
Why?
I think that sex reveals a lot about ourselves. Like the amount of people, and I'm sure you've had this experience where like you've met a person and they're really chill and like one way when you meet them. And the minute you're in a slightly sexual dynamic with them, like whether it's you and them or you see them with someone else, and they become this like animal, and they also think that that animal is an okay way to be. I have this friend who's like really like sweet and like soft-spoken and like kind of nervous, but like he's like a dom top daddy who like has these orgies and like forces all these boys to like fuck each other. And but like when you see him at work, he's like, hi, and you're like, what the fuck? It's so interesting to me, right? I also think that straight sex is so queer.
I was just gonna say, let's talk about straight sex versus, go on.
Because I do think that there is a queer dynamic at play with straight people in the ways in which straight people lean into and also attempt to reject the gender structures that like the universe has placed upon us, right?
You're basically saying when you're, this is actually something I've talked about with my parents. My parents really are like heteronormative. Like, yes. My dad is like the man and my mom's like, ooh la la. And I'm like, this is, it's so over the top. It's almost queer because yes. you're leaning so hard into these ideas. I definitely understand what you're saying.
And then like the ways in which you perform sexuality so often, like I used to hear, not on purpose because it was just dorm, but I would hear my roommate having sex with girls. And his, when I was in college, and his voice would go down like 7 octaves, like, yeah, you like that? And
it's
like,
so camp.
And their voice would go up 8 octaves, like, yeah, I love it. I love it. And I was like, why is this the performance? Like, I don't yeah. know why this is happening.
You're basically saying straight people perform gender more than queer people during sex.
Yes. I think on, or at least to the same degree, right? And I think that like, you guys give drag so well. And I love the drag. Like the straight guy drag in the gym is so next level.
I hate it. It disgusts me. I'm like, I'm out.
What disgusts okay. you about it?
I just think masculinity is so embarrassing. And I don't like go to a gym and see it, but I hate when I see like guys on, especially the way that they get addicted to like their bodies. And I just find it very unattractive.
But that's why I like the new kids a lot.
You mean the TikTok boys even specifically yeah. who kind of do this like boy yeah. band
thing. They do
sexy
a boy band
thing.
But then all of a sudden they're doing like the like girly dance and mm-hmm. like they're really playing around with the mutability of like how gender fits on a body. And I think the girls are doing that as well.
There's a self-awareness of the drag.
Yes.
Right. Well, when you're able to play with gender and make it like a hat you try on, then you can have more fun with sex.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I think my next play might be about fisting.
Okay. What about fisting?
I'm really interested in the ways in which people use the extremities of sexual experiences to not just for pleasure, but to also like reach euphoria and potentially to touch God and like which
fisting toward God.
Yes.
Toward enlightenment.
Exactly. And which people, what the difference is between people who need to do that and people who like can't fathom it, right? So like one character is someone who like is running for like very high political office. And every other character in the play are people who are like not at all interested in that and like very much want to just keep finding out how deep their hole is, right? Because also I think that's a dichotomy between like hedonism, this idea that like that we can have some radical positivity and like maybe change the world through like politics, mm-hmm. which I think, I don't know where I stand on that. Like I think that maybe we should all just smoke cigarettes and drink coffee and like fuck off because like we've ended everything. Like we fucked it all up. But then another part of me is like, no, but like I should write my political play that like takes place in DC and like gets Congress to like change their laws.
I mean, again, I hope you write the play about fisting because I do find sex and our sexual preferences so revealing about the world and the way things work and power.
Yeah.
So
I'm also writing a play about my family, which
okay,
is crazy.
That's different. That's yeah. not about sex or
no,
maybe it is. I don't know.
I mean, no, it's about like drag queens, but huh. yeah. And like
you're
Tyler
fucking
Perry.
Working on so many things.
I know too many things.
How do you do that?
I don't know. How do you do it?
I'm tired all the time.
Yeah, same. I don't sleep.
But writing's different. Writing, switching gears with writing is really difficult for me. I have to be working on one project. I can't.
Are you working on another book?
No. I just started writing a new essay for the first time since the book came out. It's really hard. I'm sure you had this experience. Once you know that your work is going to be perceived by the world, it changes it. Mm-hmm. When I was writing the book, like I was like, no one fucking thinks this is going to be any good. No one cares. And so it was really great for me to just play and yes. like do whatever. And now every time I start to write, I think about how it would land in the world. And that is ultimately just the worst for writing. So I'm going to find a way to trick myself. I've started to a little bit.
Well, you know, Elizabeth Hardwick said to Daryl Pickney, who was he's written a book about her, but she said, all the best writing comes out of desperation or revenge.
Everything I have ever done is for revenge.
Yeah.
To prove something, essentially, yes. right? So desperation and revenge. And maybe that is kind of the crucial part of being an artist, right? You having something to prove. We're at the end of our time. Yeah. I like had a million questions for you, but
what other questions did you have for me?
I mean, I was gonna ask you about your mom and writing, honestly. I was just curious like what her relationship is to your writing and like what does she read and I don't know, like about your childhood and stuff.
And like my mom is really funny. My mom loves that I'm a writer. She used to ask me in my 20s when I couldn't afford to give her things, to just write her a poem, or, and she's kept every single thing I wrote her.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, and I'm forever grateful for her. Like, the first thing I did when I got like a lot of money is I bought her a house, and I was like, you can quit your job, go to college, like do whatever you want. So she's like getting her degree right now, and that's like amazing. Exploring things. And she just started reading Octavia Butler.
Wow.
And like loves it
so
much.
We were just
much.
Talking about Octavia Butler because Andrea Long Chu was on the podcast, and she just wrote a really great piece about Octavia Butler that you should read and send to your mom.
I will definitely read it.
It's really brilliant. It's for Vulture.
Oh my God.
Yeah, New York Magazine.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm gonna read it now.
I'm really grateful for you in general. I like how your brain works a lot.
I'm so grateful for you. And we need to have more dinners.
All right, that was Jeremy O'Harris. If you haven't looked up his work or are curious about Slave Play or Daddy, you can actually read them. So support Jeremy. Go buy a copy of Slave Play. It's actually a really interesting read. I saw it on stage and also have read it, and I enjoyed both. Really thought-provoking. Very excited to hear all of your thoughts on the many things that Jeremy covered. Go to hilo.fm for our subscription episode if you want to send in voice memos or thoughts. Thank you so much. Hi Lo with Emrata is a Sony Music Entertainment, Bitch Era Media, and Something Else production produced by Chelsea Jacobson. Our executive producers are me, Emily Radikowski, and Sarita Wesley. Our senior producer is Medina Parwana, and our associate producer is Rachel Choder. Today's episode was engineered by Samantha Gatzik, with original music by The Crystal Pharaoh. Thanks for listening.